Dr. Charlie Bamforth joins me this week to discuss foam and head retention in beer. This is Beersmith Podcast number 231.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 231, and it's late February 2021. Dr. Charlie Bamforth joins me this week to discuss foam and head retention in beer. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers. They offer access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com. And also the Brew Commander, the new brewhouse controller from Blickman Engineering. It's available in electric and gas propane models. The patent-pending Brew Commander is a high-quality brewhouse controller that offers automated step mashing, boil timers, precision temperature control, and advanced settings. Command your brew day with the new Brew Commander. To order yours today, go to BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, I urge you to give Beersmith 3 brewing software a try. If you haven't yet downloaded the 3.1 update, grab it now as it includes improved data storage, additional dry hop options, new mash pH models, new add-ons, and much more. To download your free 21-day trial, go to beersmith.com today. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, my guest is Dr. Charlie Bamforth, Professor Emeritus of Malting and Brewing Science at the University of California at Davis. Charlie specializes in the study of wholesomeness of beer, including beer perception, polyphenols, foam stability, oxidation, and flavor stability. And Charlie, it's a pleasure again to have you on the show.
Well, it's always nice to be with you. It's been several years now. Yeah.
We've been doing this since 2010, believe it or not.
Really? So yeah. 11 years. I can't even subtract it. Yeah, 11 years. My word.
That's amazing.
I'm just as bald and as gray as I was then. So there we go. I've aged well.
Well, anyways, it's great to have you here. And today you wanted to talk a little bit about foam. But first, I think you have to explain how you got the moniker, the Pope of Foam, because I've heard that more than once now.
Yeah. Well, I heard it from a student. A student came over, a guy called Jean-Pierre Biawa, a wonderful guy from Cameroon. And before coming to me, he'd been a student in Berlin. And he said to me one day, he said, you know what they call you in Berlin? And I thought, well, I can imagine. But he said, they call you the Pope of Foam. So I rather like that. That was very nice. German brewers don't give English brewing people much credit, but they gave me a bit there. So that was nice. And some people call me the Sultan of Suds, which I'm not
Sultan
sure.
Sultan of Suds. Now, that one I have not heard before. That's new.
Yeah. But I hate it when people refer to beer foam as suds. I mean, suds belongs on washing up, in the kitchen sink, not on beer. But anyway, it's all in good fun.
That's pretty funny. Foam is a pretty broad topic, actually. It's obviously related to carbonation levels. Let's start with that. How do we measure carbonation, and how do we tell how carbonated our beer is to start?
It is about the carbonation. Obviously, if you didn't have gas in the beer, you wouldn't get the bubbles. Beers are supersaturated solutions of carbon dioxide. So there's a lot of CO2 in pretty much any beer, some more than others. In terms of measuring it, there are several techniques, but the standard way that is applied in a brewery is basically to say you've got a bottle, to basically pierce a hole in the cap and allow the gas to release. And you measure the pressure that you get at a given temperature. So according to gas laws, there's a relationship between pressure, volume, and temperature. And if you keep the temperature constant and you release the gas, then you can either measure the pressure that is given, or you can do it, what they say, manometrically, and you can measure the volume of carbon dioxide. So it's probably not something that most homebrewers are going to be doing, but it's a routine technique in breweries, whether it's bottles, cans, packaged kegs, or beer out of tanks.
Yeah, and I think most of us from homebrewing, we work in carbonation levels in volumes, although I've seen grams per liter listed too, I think, or something like grams per milliliter. I can't remember.
Grams per liter, yeah. The simple rule of thumb is if you multiply by 2, you convert volumes into grams per liter. So if you got, say, 2 volumes, in other words, 2 milliliters of carbon dioxide in a milliliter of beer, then that's about 4 grams per liter. Beers, some of them at the lower end of the range, and some are right up there at the top end.
And of course, volumes is how much volume of CO2 you put into a given volume, right? So it's kind of, it's actually measureless technically, but
yeah,
dimensionless.
Yeah, it is really, because, you know, it's dissolved in there, in the case of carbon dioxide. And, if you've got to measure it, if you want to bring it out, you've got to basically release it. You've got to agitate. You've got to shake it out to release it. But so, as I say, if you have a bottle of beer and you open it ever so gently, you'll get some CO2 released, but not a lot. You've really got to put some energy in there, some effort in there to release the carbon dioxide, whether you're in the business of measuring it, or if you're in the business of trying to produce some bubbles during dispense.
Yeah, and as I mentioned, so volumes is, you think about like a volume is a liter of CO2 dissolved in a liter of beer, I guess, right?
Yeah, so the definition is, so if somebody says, oh, this beer is 2.5 volumes, what it means is that if you measure it, you've got 2.5 milliliters of carbon dioxide that you can release from a milliliter of beer.
And makes
so
sense.
2.5 to 1, yeah.
And 2.5 is kind of a reasonable carbonation level for something here in the U.S., right?
Yeah, that's typical. That's a typical sort of carbonation level for, say, a small pack beer in across the world, really. So many beers are in that range. If I think back to my bringing up in the brewing industry in the UK, kegged beer in the UK, in other words, beer under carbon dioxide pressure in kegs in the UK, that was usually around 2.2 volumes. Over here, it may be a bit higher than that. But the cask conditioned ale, the stuff that really is my personal favorite, the stuff you hand pump out from the barrel, that is much lower. The typical CO2 level there is going to be around 1.2 volumes. So that's still needed 2.5 grams per liter. So that's, and it just shows how soluble CO2 is. So it's still a respectable amount of CO2. But what it means is if you're trying to produce a foam on a cask conditioned ale, you've got to put more effort in than if you're pouring out a beer from a bottle. Some of the highest carbonated beers are beers like the Hefeweizens. So a Hefeweizen is usually going to be in excess of 3 volumes, so more than 6 grams per liter. So, one of my big bugbears is when I go into a bar and I see somebody pouring the beer really slowly, ever so gently, trying to avoid producing the foam. Well, they would have a hard job doing that if you're pouring out a bottle of Hefeweizen, because there's so much CO2 in there. Despite their best efforts to avoid foam formation, they're going to get some. But you really do have to work to actually release that carbon dioxide to produce a foam.
And of course, if you go to Germany and get one of those Hefeweizens, they pour it several times, actually, right?
Yeah, and that would be one example. Another example would be, of course, Guinness in Ireland, where if you order a pint of Guinness, then you've got to be patient, because it's going to take several minutes. They're basically going to, first of all, pour out a glass full of foam, And then they'll let the liquid drain, liquid will collect, and then they'll progressively top up and top up and top up, such that you've got your pint of Guinness with that fantastic foam on the top of it. But, you know, it'll take several minutes for that to happen.
But that's not, I mean, that's not highly carbonated, though, is it, to start with? That's not super carbonated.
No, not especially, yeah. But it is an exercise in really, you know, what is Guinness without that wonderful small bubbles, white foam? I mean, that's part of it. The rich black beer with that fantastic white foam on the top. I mean, that's part of it. And in most parts of the world, the foam is absolutely essential. I'm not sure if I've ever told you this before, but back in Europe, I started the European Brewery Convention Foam Subgroup, which was a collection of scientists all over Europe that were studying foam. And I remember a German scientist said to me, "Why you? Why are you chairing this? You're English. You don't know anything about foam." And I said, with a smile on my face and respectfully, I said, "Well, you're German. You don't know anything about England. You've probably only ever been to London. And there, yeah, chances are you probably get a reasonably flat-looking beer with no foam on it. But if you go north, if you go up to Sheffield or Newcastle or somewhere like that, then you've got a pint of liquid and you've got that foam on top. And woe betide the brewer or the quality control manager if there ain't that stable foam on the top and foam that lasts all the way down." So there are tremendous regional differences. So if you go to Europe, there's many countries where you'll basically get half a glass of beer and half a glass of foam. And being English, I like my full pint, but I like the foam on top, which is why the glasses in England, say, are oversized. There's a line which indicates the pint of liquid, and then the space on the top for the foam. And you can go to the Czech Republic, you can get different types of pour, and one of those pours is essentially just a glass full of foam. So it just goes to show how you, depending on how you dispense the beer, you can produce a lot of foam, you can produce very little foam, and it really is at the dispense end where the foam is made or broken. It really is. Like so much else, that it's if the bar person or the customer doesn't do things right, then there won't be any foam, no matter how good the beer is.
What makes the actual bubbles of foam? Obviously, it's trapping CO2 and inside the bubbles, but what's the surface material that actually kind of holds it all together?
Yeah, well, it's a complicated scenario in that like I said, first of all, you've got to release those bubbles. So it's either agitation. If you've got a can of Guinness, it's a widget. Or it could be these glasses. I'm sitting right now. I'm in Chico today at the brewery. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just behind me is the bar. Sadly, not open at the moment because of COVID. And there, the beer is dispensed into these glasses that have got nucleation sites on the bottom. These are etchings on the bottom of the glass. And that is where the CO2 is released.
And when we talk about nucleation, I always think of like the Diet Coke and Mentos kind of experiment, right?
Yeah,
you're dropping something,
right.
Mentos, the surface of the Mentos has a lot of, you said, rough surface with nucleation sites, and that causes the bubbles to be released.
Yeah. And so you release them either through simple agitation, which is the basis of the hand pump in the UK, or you have some sort of nucleation site. Now, it could be particles. If you've got particles in the beer, the bubbles will release on those. So something like Hefeweizen, again, has got a lot going for it because it's not only got all that CO2, it's actually got nucleation sites in the form of the insoluble material. So, yeah, you have to have this nucleation taking place. Now, of course, we all know of other beverages that have got plenty of carbon dioxide in them. Champagne. So champagne, you get a lot of effervescence, but you don't get a stable foam.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is that when you make bubbles, you're producing a lot of surface area. And that is exactly opposed to a physical force called surface tension. Mm-hmm. So if you put some liquid, you put a drop of water onto a clean surface, it occupies a droplet shape. And that's because it's the smallest area that is commensurate with that amount, that volume of water. So if you make a foam, you produce a huge surface. So if you opened up all those bubbles and you spread them out, it'd be the size of a small room on a pint of beer. So that's diametrically opposed to surface tension. So getting around to your question, what is it about beer? Well, beer contains what we call surface active materials, substances that go into the bubble wall and link up with one another and hold the shape of the bubble. And therefore, they, to an extent, they're trapping gas, but really what they're doing is making a framework to hold that bubble shape together. And these materials come from the raw materials, from the malt and from the hops. So these are surface active materials which counter the surface tension.
So is all that structure on the top of the beer? I mean, is it on the surface of the beer that it's happening, or is it happening also as the bubbles flow up through the beer?
Well, as the bubbles are produced, these surface active materials migrate and they basically get into the bubble.
Interesting.
So the wall of the bubble is the beer, is liquid. So, and of course, it contains protein and it contains the bitter acids, because these are the two major materials which stabilize the foam. So those interactions between the proteins and the bitter acids don't occur in the beer itself. They occur in the surface. So, you can classify chemical substances into those which are so-called hydrophilic and those that are hydrophobic. So hydrophilic molecules, as the name would suggest, they like water. They like water. But hydrophobic materials are not comfortable in water, so they tend to get out and go to a surface. So these molecules which get into the bubble wall, they're the more hydrophobic ones, and they tend to leave the beer and they stick around in the surface. And so they are hydrophobic proteins. And the bitter substances, which themselves are from the hops, they are very hydrophobic. So it's a combination of these things. Now, there are other physical forces at play. So although you're making this shape, the bubbles, carbon dioxide can still pass from one bubble to the next bubble. And so if you have different sizes of bubbles, the gas will pass from the small bubble into the big bubble. And eventually the small bubble will get smaller and smaller and smaller and then disappear. And the big bubble will get big and ugly. And I usually call it bladdery. And there's only half as many bubbles. Now, this got a fancy term. It's called disproportionation. But this physical force is very important. So what I'm saying is the chemistry is very important, these proteins and bitter substances, but the physics is also very important. And so that's why when you dispense beer, what you really need to ensure as much as possible is all the bubbles are essentially the same size and they're all small, because small bubbles give more stable foams than big ones. And this comes back to the nucleation, the nucleation sites. The finer the site, the finer the bubble. And when you're dispensing from a tap, you may have a widget on the end of the tap. And by tightening that, you can squeeze things out and make smaller bubbles and so on. So there's a huge, huge amount in this. And so far, Brad, we've only touched the surface, if you pardon the expression.
it's pretty amazing. So, I mean, obviously, if you get the bubbles get too big, they collapse, right?
Yeah. So big bubbles are uglier. Not only that, there's all sorts of explanations for why the foam with smaller bubbles is more stable. One of the main ones is if you imagine that you've got all these small bubbles, lots and lots of small bubbles all crammed together, the liquid beer in between those bubbles drains away much more slowly than it does from bigger bubbles, so that you get less lower rates of drainage. Mm-hmm. And that also is important for keeping the foam together. Now, there's a fancy equation, which we needn't go into, that explains this disproportionation. But the most important parts of this equation are, first of all, temperature. The higher the temperature, the more rapidly foam collapses. Now, that is the opposite of foam formation. If you pour out a warm beer as opposed to pouring out a cold beer, you will produce a lot more foam at the higher temperature. And that's because the gas is less soluble. And so it's easier to produce foam at a higher temperature. Mm-hmm. But if you look at foam stability, then the foam is much more stable at lower temperatures. So if you've got a beer that's being dispensed at, say, I'm going to use centigrade because I always do, don't I?
That's
Celsius.
Fine. Yeah.
So if you pour it out, say, out of the refrigerator at 4, then you're going to get a more stable foam than if you pour it out a dispenser at, say, classic drinking temperature in the UK. And I will, because I do know what that number is in Fahrenheit, 55 Fahrenheit. So. Mm. So the difference between, you know, that say 40 Fahrenheit as opposed to 55 Fahrenheit, the foam is going to be more stable at the lower temperature. And the other important factor is the gas solubility. The carbon dioxide is very soluble and happily passes between bubbles. But if you put something like nitrogen gas into the beer, then nitrogen is very insoluble and it doesn't go from bubble to bubble. So what it does is it basically bombards the wall and it helps hold it together without passing into the next bubble. Mm. And now the amount of nitrogen that you can use is much less than carbon dioxide. You might have only about 50 milligrams per liter of nitrogen in your beer, as opposed to, you know, 5 grams per liter of CO2, but even that is a lot of nitrogen molecules, and this is why nitrogen gives you very stable foam.
We talked earlier about Guinness. I mean, that's used in Guinness, right?
It is.
Yeah.
And Guinness pioneered the use of nitrogen gas, but others have taken it on board as well. I will confess that in when I was with Bass, we used to put a little bit of nitrogen when we kegged beer. We usually put a little bit of nitrogen into those kegs, even something like the lager, the Carling Black Label, a little bit of nitrogen, because every little bit helped to improve the foam stability. We didn't want to put in so much nitrogen that it influenced the flavor, because nitrogen does influence the flavor of the beer significantly.
So how does it change the flavor then?
Various ways. The first one is that it changes the mouthfeel. With nitrogen, you get a much more luscious, smoother mouthfeel. The second reason is, and this is particularly relevant for something like Guinness, is it tends to temper the harsher roasted character. And this is why you can get cold serve coffee these days. Because the same thing, the nitrogen will temper some of the harsher, less forgiving roasted notes. But the third thing, and this is the real deal breaker for me, for nitrogen, is that the nitrogen suppresses hop aroma. Mm-hmm. I don't know that anybody's fully explained why, but there's no question that if you have nitrogen in a beer, and it really does lower the hop oil character, the aromas that you're going to get from the oils. Now, of course, Guinness does not have a hoppy nose.
No.
So it's not an issue. But if you're putting nitrogen, say, into a double IPA, mm-hmm. there, and you're really looking for a big hop nose, then nitrogen isn't going to be doing that any favors. Mm.
Well, let's go back to the brewing process. What are the key ingredients from the beer that eventually lead to these compounds that promote head retention?
Well, Okay, so I mentioned the proteins, and they come from the malt. In malted barley, there are proteins. Some people talk about specific types of proteins that are important, and they are important, called lipid transfer protein and protein Z. But there are many proteins in beer, and they all have a greater or lesser amount of foam stabilizing ability. And as I said, the bitter substances that that come from the hops, they too will allow you to get much more stable foams. And what is happening when you pour your beer is, as I've already said, the proteins and the bitter substances, they migrate into the foam and they interact. And it takes a little bit of time. So when you pour out your beer, first of all, and you look at it, that foam is fairly liquid and wet. Mm-hmm. But if you wait and look at it and watch it, you get a stiffening taking place. The foam almost solidifies. And that's evidence for this protein and bitter substance interaction. So now you've got this solid foam. And now when you drink your beer, steadily enjoying it, savoring it, having a nice conversation or whatever, then your foam is now going to lace the side of the glass, cling on the side of the glass, mm-hmm. as long as it's a clean glass, and you're going to have this lacing foam adhesion taking place. I often talk about cathedral windows of foam, and it's just beautiful. And that's because of this protein bitterness interaction. Mm-hmm. Now, some people use hop extracts, and one of them in particular is often touted for its ability to improve foam stability, and that is the one of the names is tetra hop. It's the reduced isobar acids that really were developed to provide light resistance, to prevent skunking. Mm-hmm. The Miller Brewing Company, of course, were great pioneers in this area. Now, that is very, very hydrophobic material. And that really gives very, very stable foams. But they're so stable, they don't always look terribly appealing. You know, I've even seen things that look like icebergs floating on the top of beer. And that's a sure sign that you've got these reduced side chain isobar acids. Tell you a story, Brad. When I first arrived at UC Davis, I actually was invited over to a very, very famous large brewing company headquartered in St. Louis, and was asked to give a presentation. So I talked about foam, and I showed all these photographs of foam. And when I finished, Doug Moorman, the top VP of all matters technical, said, "Charlie, it was very good." I said, "Thank you." He said, "Why did you just show us pictures of Miller beer?" And they could tell it was beer that had been produced using this reduced side chain isoalpha acid. So we laugh about it now.
So can you talk a little bit about hops? What are the compounds? I mean, you talk about the bittering compounds. You talk primarily alpha acid, or is there other compounds in hops that are contributing?
Yeah, it's primarily the isoalpha acids. So it's the bitter substances that are produced when the alpha acids are isomerized. So there are subtle differences between the different isoalpha acids. Mm-hmm. Some are probably better, slightly better for foam than others, but it's not a huge thing. So the bottom line is, the more bitterness in the beer, the more foam stabilizing potential is there. And so if you've got a very low bitterness beer, you can still produce a stable foam, but mm-hmm. you've got to work harder at it. But if you've got something like a high enough 50 IBU product, and it's all malt, so you've got a lot of protein coming from the malt, then you've got a lot of foam positive materials.
So primarily alpha acid we're concerned about there, and obviously a lot of the IPAs we make today are have huge IBU levels, right?
Correct. And so all things being equal, the higher the the proportion of malt in the grist, and the higher the bitterness level in the beer, the better the foam potential. Mm. Now, it's not quite as simple as that. So there is a balance between foam positive components and foam negatives. So on the one hand, the main foam positives are the proteins and the bitter acids, but the main foam negative material is alcohol. Mm. So ethanol itself is very foam negative. So this is where the balance comes in. You know, I say, you know, the higher the alcohol content of the beer, all things being equal, the less good the foam is going to be. And people say, Charlie, what are you talking about? We've got a barley wine. It's 9-10% alcohol, and it's got a pretty good foam. And I say, yeah, because it's 100% malt. You've got a shed load of bitterness in there, and they are countering the effect of the alcohol. But if you're making malt liquor, mm-hmm. and you've got a relatively low proportion of malt, and you've got a relatively low bitterness, but you've got a lot of alcohol, then all things being equal, the alcohol is going to win through. You know, we've all heard about these crazy alcohol beers, you know, the 50, 60, 70 almost percent ABV beers. I wouldn't buy those. You pour them out. I guarantee you, if you can afford to pour them out, there'll be no foam whatsoever on those beers. Mm-hmm. Because at that level of alcohol, it completely destroys any foam stabilizing capability. So all things, you know, if you've got all malt, you've got a high bitterness, then, you know, the foam at 4% is going to be better than it is at 8%. But then again, if you've got a huge amount of oomph in the beer, you know, you probably want, you know, that to be in a higher alcohol one as well, you know. So there aren't too many outrageously bitter low alcohol products. So
no, that's true.
It's all a balance. It is all a balance.
Well, we talked a little bit about the hops. Can you talk a little about malts? What malts might I want to select to give me the most proteins and the most foam stability?
Yeah. There's all sorts of dogma in this area. But fundamentally, this protein, foam stabilizing protein in all malts. One thing that people have realized for many years now, and this is fact, it's an absolute fact, that the proteins from wheat are better than the proteins from barley. So molecule for molecule, the foam stabilizing ability of wheat proteins is better than barley protein. So there are many brewers I know over the years who, even for, you know, malted barley based beers, put a little bit of wheat material in there. It may not necessarily even be malted wheat, but the wheat proteins do tend to have better foam stability. Now, one piece of received wisdom that many of your listeners may have heard is that some of the specialty malts are very good for foam stability, things like the crystal malts and the caramel malts. It's a complicated story. I had a student, Alex Coombe, a few years ago, who showed that some of the crystal malts, for example, have got a lot of foam negative material in them. There's a lot of materials in there which actually damage foam. And he showed, and a subsequent student called Justin Ang, showed that they were lipids, fats, oxidized materials produced during the process. So we found that they're pretty foam negative, these materials. Now, a famous brewer from California, and it's not the one that I'm sitting in today, mm-hmm. Read this. He actually employed Mr. Ang, so perhaps that's where the idea came from. And he took the crystal malt out of their grist bill.
Okay.
And they got excessive amounts of foaming in the process. So one of the things that people have realized for a long time is that if you suppress foaming in the process, then the foam stability in the finished beer is better because you've kept those foam positive materials in solution. So when it comes to the crystal malts, you've got two competing effects. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, if they're present, they they act as antifoams, so they help to suppress foaming during fermentation, which is a good thing. But if those foam negative materials get in into the finished beer, they're foam negative and they damage the foam. So as long as they're being removed on the yeast and perhaps by filtration or something like that, on balance, it is entirely possible that, yes, indeed, the crystal malts, for example, have a net positive effect. But on just taken on their own, they're actually got a lot of foam negative, which as well as the foam positive. Now, of all the malts that we've ever investigated, the ones with superb foam performance are the heavily roasted ones. So roasted malt, chocolate malt, black malt, roast barley, they've got fantastic foam stabilizing capability. And my longstanding collaborator, Makoto Kanauchi, and I, with another student called Emily Kultgen, who's with Miller Coors these days, we found there's a very small molecule which is produced during roasting. It's only a tiny molecule. It's got a few amino acids that there's things you get in proteins, got a few of those, but it's during the roasting process, they become fused together with another complicated molecule, and they give a very, very foam-stabilizing effect. Unfortunately, Brad, you know, black malt is not an answer to poor foam performance on a pale lager beer.
So I assume there's other things you can do. Can you talk a little about the brewing process itself, and are there things you can do during the brewing process to aid aid in foam retention?
You can. The number one thing, is of course to suppress, you know, to avoid excessive foaming as much as possible. I remember once going into a brewery and they said, you know, the foam in our beer is rubbish. And I looked down and there was foam all over the brewery floor. And, you know, and I said, well, if it's on the floor, it ain't in the beer, is it? the first thing that you can do is attend to the mashing stage. There are two long-standing truisms that I think are right, although there are different explanations for why they work. The first is you need to mash in at the highest temperature possible. In keeping with breaking down the starch, obviously you can't go excessively high. Mm-hmm. But what I'm really saying is, if at all possible, avoid a low temperature start to mashing. So if you mash straight in, I'm going to use Celsius. If you mash straight in at 65, then all things being equal, the foam stability is going to be better than if you mash in at, say, 45 and then raise the temperature. The second thing is the lower the pH of the mash within reason, the better the foam stability. So if you're mashing at, say, 5.5, 5.6, then the foam stability is not as good as, say, 5.1 or 5.2. Now, there are two conflicting explanations for this. Some people think it's all to do with the proteins, and they think that the higher temperature and the lower the pH, the less damage to the foam protein. I don't think that's the case. I don't think that's the explanation. At the higher temperature and at the lower pH, you suppress the activity of an enzyme called lipoxygenase. And this is the enzyme that makes oxidized fatty acids. And we showed, Kum and Ang and I showed, that these are the most significant foam negative materials that are coming from certain malts. So I think it's preventing lipid oxidation. I think that is the reason why the higher temperature, lower pH work. Further on, another thing is the yeast. Mm-hmm. If yeast gets old and tired and stressed, then it gives poorer foam performance. My closest friend in the brewing industry, Graham Stewart, who I've been a colleague of and a friend of for 40-odd years now, he's done a lot of work in this area. And it all stemmed from high-gravity brewing. And of course, Graham is the world's doyen on high-gravity brewing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he knew from his early days working at Labatt Brewing Company in London, Ontario, Canada, that the high gravity brewed beer gives foam, which is less good than that from a beer brewed at lower gravities. And the main reason for this is that when yeast is fermenting at high gravities, high specific gravities, it releases an enzyme, a proteinase, which damages the proteins. And so the more stress the yeast becomes, whether it's high gravity, high alcohol, age, using yeast too many generations, then the yeast, when it becomes stressed, will release this problematic enzyme. So that is why I personally am not a fan of reusing yeast too many times. And certainly when yeast has ever been near high alcohol brew, you should never attempt to use it again. I remember talking about this down in the West Country where my wife is from, down in Cornwall, in the toe of England down there. And this guy in the audience said, well, how many generations do you recommend? And I said, no more than 10. And he was from one of these very traditional brewers that have gone from generation to generation, fermenter to fermenter for years. And he said there were something like 6,927 or something like that generations. And I said, just go
for more it. Than 10, right?
Yeah, more than 10. But as I said earlier on, Brad, you know, it's pretty much any beer, even the very low bitterness, higher adjunct beers, they still have a lot of foam potential in them. Mm-hmm. But you've got to try harder. You've really got to make sure that the dispense conditions are right.
Well, that was actually the next point I wanted to bring out, perhaps the last big topic we want to discuss. You talked a little bit about glasses, but I mean, even the shape of the glass can affect how the beer is perceived and the head retention and everything. And then also, I want you to talk about serving the beer and how important it is to serve the beer under the right conditions.
Well, it's critical. It's critical. Now, you know, what I'm fond of saying is, you know, the correct glass foam is the one that's got the right name on it and not got the wrong name on it. So when you're pouring out a beer, yes, the shape of the glass may have, I would say, almost a marginal effect. Mm-hmm. I know that people have designed glasses and they make all sorts of claims about this one is best for foam and this one. And, you know, if you've got a simple glass that slopes down, tapers down, then that's not as good as one that sort of bows at the top. And I understand all that. But that is vastly, vastly, vastly less important than making sure that glass is clean. It's the cleanliness of the glass which is far more important than the shape of the glass. So that's why the glasses have got to be washed properly. They've got to be washed quite apart, separate from any food, any plates, anything like that. And they must never be washed alongside the beer glasses. Must be clean water. It's got to have a good detergent in there, an efficient detergent. You've got to make sure they're thoroughly cleaned inside and out. And you've got to make sure you get rid of that detergent. And so you've got to rinse that detergent away inside and outside. You know, I see people carrying their glasses, five glasses in each hand with their fingers in the glasses. Well, your fingers have got grease on them. That's fat. So any residual fat, any residual detergent, they're just going to screw up the foam. And you can always tell a dirty glass because, you know, and it happens, I don't know, 8 times out of 10 when pre-COVID days, would go into a restaurant or a bar and I'd look at the glass. And even my wife's reached the stage now, she says, you got a dirty glass because you got these ugly bubbles on the side of the glass. You've not even started drinking it yet, but you've got these coarse bubbles that are, you can see them sticking on the inside surface. And wherever those are, That's a greasy spot. That's not been washed properly.
And those are lipids, right? You talked about earlier about lipids or oils, basically.
It's lipids and oils and so on. And what they're doing is they're forming a site where these ugly bubbles can be produced. But those bubbles are not part of the foam. They're just evidence that you've got some lipid and detergent there. And that lipid, some of it's going to get off, and you'll see that the foam is not going to be as good. You'll see that the foam, the bubbles, are going to be bigger in that dirty glass. The best way to check whether the glasses are being washed properly is to get them to wet the empty glass and to sprinkle salt all over the inside surface. And if there's any part on a glass where the salt is not sticking, that is a greasy spot. Mm-hmm. So when I was a QA manager, the Bass Brewery near Liverpool, in the northwest of England, and people in Yorkshire, because this was on the west of the Pennines, so the beer was shipped over to Yorkshire on the east of the Pennines, and of course there's this rivalry, and they'd say, beer's rubbish, because it's come from over there. The beer's rubbish, the foam is lousy. And 99 times out of 100, it wasn't the beer. It was the way in which it was being dispensed. It was the glasses were not being properly washed, or the beer wasn't being dispensed properly. I mentioned earlier on these, you know, the sparklers on the end of a tap and on a beer tap, and you could adjust them. You can tighten them and you could loosen them to, and this basically restrains the flow to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. Well, we used to go into bars and find that they'd unscrewed them because it made the flow much faster. Well, there was no sparkler there. You weren't releasing, you weren't making the foam properly. And so, but they did it because, you know, it might be a pub that's on the way to a soccer ground or something. You got 50,000 people, some of whom want to have a beer, several beers before they go, and they don't want to wait around, you know, for the foam. And so we made them tamper-proof so they couldn't unscrew them. And heck, you know, they started sawing them off. I mean, they got fret saws and sawed the sparklers off. You
know? Time is money, huh?
Well, everything goes against foam stability, you know?
Yeah.
If you care about presentation, it's got to be the right glass, but it's got to be washed properly. And it's got to be done with care and handled properly and dispensed properly. So as I say, it's invariably the case. It's even for the gentlest flavored, highest adjunct, lowest bitterness beer, it's not the beer's fault when it comes to foam stability. It's at the dispense end.
Well, Charlie, unfortunately, we're coming to the end of our time, but I wanted to get your closing thoughts on foam stability and what we can do as brewers to end to end to make things better.
All of the above, but good brewing practice. What I would say to anybody, to any brewer who is selling their beer into the trade, do the right things. There are things you can do in terms of grist selection and mashing and yeast age and so on. But the number one thing to attend to first, above all else, is at the trade end. That is above all the most important thing to focus on. And it's only if you can be confident that your beer is being presented correctly that you should then start to and if you've checked that, you know, if you're troubleshooting, you've checked in and said, now the beer is being dispensed correctly, it is going into clean glasses, there must be something wrong with the beer, then that is the time to start looking at what might be creeping in terms of a negative, what might be missing in terms of a positive. If I could give you an advertisement, if people go to the American Society of Brewing Chemists bookstore, and there's a whole series of books on different aspects of beer quality that I wrote, and the first one of those was foam. Mm. And there's a troubleshooting guide there to sorting out if anything really is wrong with the beer. But don't start tinkering around with things until you're confident the beer is being poured properly.
Well, Charlie, as always, it's been a great show, and I really appreciate you coming on today.
Oh, it's my absolute pleasure. We'll run out of topics soon, won't we? I don't know.
Never. We'll never run out of topics, Trey. It's a great pleasure to have Dr. Charlie Bamforth on today, Professor Emeritus of Malting and Brewing Science at the University of California at Davis. Thank you again, Charlie.
Pleasure.
A big thank you to Dr. Charlie Bamforth for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They're offering access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. And also the Brew Commander, the new brewhouse controller from Blickman Engineering. It's available in gas and electric propane models. This patent-pending Brew Commander is a high-quality brewhouse controller that offers automated step mashing, boil timers, precision temperature control, and advanced settings. Command your brew day with the new Brew Commander. To order yours today, go to blickmanengineering.com. For more information, again, that's blickmanengineering.com. And finally, I urge you to give Beersmith 3 Brewing Software a try. If you've not downloaded the new 3.1 update, grab it now, as it includes improved data storage, additional dry hop options, new mash pH models, new add-ons, and much more. To download your free 21-day trial, go to beersmith.com today. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a great brewing week.